from New York, this is Democracy Now! As the United States reports nearly 60,000 new coronavirus cases, the highest daily toll since August, the Trump administration has reportedly adopted a policy of herd immunity, deliberately letting the virus infect much of the U.S. population. This comes despite warnings from the World Health Organization.
Letting the virus circulate unchecked, therefore, means allowing unnecessary infections, suffering, and death.
However, some public health professionals are supporting a herd immunity strategy.
The longer it takes until we reach herd immunity, the more difficult it is to protect the high-risk elderly and other high-risk people. So that's why this age-targeted strategy or risk-targeted strategy, in my view, is the one that will minimize the death in the long term.
We'll host a debate on herd immunity and how best to confront the virus. Plus, we'll air excerpts from the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States reported nearly 60,000 new coronavirus cases on Wednesday, the highest daily toll since August. About 1,000 U.S. residents died of COVID-19 in just 24 hours, bringing the death toll since March to nearly 217,000, still the highest in the world. In Wisconsin, a county judge Wednesday issued a temporary injunction barring Governor Tony Evers' emergency orders limiting the size of indoor gatherings, a legal victory for state Republicans and the Tavern League of Wisconsin, which sued to overturn limits on gatherings in restaurants and bars. The ruling came as Wisconsin officials opened a field hospital near Milwaukee to deal with a surge in COVID-19 patients, with new infections at record levels and nearly 9 in 10 hospital beds already occupied. At the University of Alabama, head football coach Nick Saban and athletic director Greg Byrne have tested positive for coronavirus. The diagnoses come after the Southeastern Conference canceled two games this weekend due to COVID-19 outbreaks, Vanderbilt at Missouri and LSU at Florida. The Florida cancellation came just days after Gators coach Dan Mullen called on his university to pack 90,000 students and fans into the Gainesville football stadium, citing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's lifting of all restrictions on the size of public gatherings. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports during the early days of the pandemic in February, the Trump administration gave wealthy Republican Party donors at the Hoover Institution advance warning about the threat posed by coronavirus, even as President Trump and White House officials made rosy statements minimizing the threat of COVID-19 to the public. The insider warning came ahead of a stock market crash. At the White House, First Lady Melania Trump said Wednesday her 14-year-old son, Barron Trump, has recovered from a mild case of COVID-19, writing in a statement, quote, "Luckily, he's a strong teenager and exhibited no symptoms." Melania Trump says she experienced a roller coaster of symptoms after her diagnosis in early October with body aches, a cough, headaches, and extreme fatigue. At least 40 people have been linked to a White House cluster of cases centered around a super spreader event on September 26th. On the campaign trail, President Trump continued to defy the urgent warnings of his own public health officials as he rallied thousands of maskless supporters Wednesday at a packed campaign rally at the airport in Des Moines, Iowa. A billboard along the way to the rally featured an arrow pointing toward the airport with the words "Trump COVID Super Spreader Event" in white letters over a red background. Trump's rally came as Iowa hit a record level of COVID-19 hospitalizations with outbreaks at more than 60 long-term care facilities and test positivity rates above 20%. Iowa is considered a yellow zone by the CDC, and according to the Trump administration's own guidelines, public gatherings should be limited to 25 people or less. It was thought there were something like 2,500 people at that rally. Trump is planning another rally today in Greenville, North Carolina, another state experiencing near record levels of infection. Coronavirus cases are surging across Europe as colder weather forces people indoors, with an exponential spread of COVID-19 prompting new lockdowns across parts of the continent. On Wednesday, French President Emmanuel Macron announced a 4-week nightly curfew for Paris and 8 other French cities beginning Saturday as hospitalizations in France surged to an all-time high. Germany reported nearly 7,000 new coronavirus cases Thursday, its highest daily rate since the early days of the pandemic. Chancellor Angela Merkel met Wednesday with the governors of Germany's 16 states to plan new social distancing guidelines and mask-wearing rules. Disease modelers say that if 95% of Europeans immediately begin wearing masks while in public, Europe could avoid more than 280,000 deaths by February. Back in the United States, Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett faced 8 more hours of questioning on Wednesday as Republicans raced to confirm her before Election Day. Barrett is a right-wing judge who once clerked for Antonin Scalia. If confirmed, Barrett will give conservatives a 6-3 majority. On Wednesday, she refused to say if she thinks climate change is happening when questioned by Democratic Senator Kamala Harris, Joe Biden's running mate.
And do you believe that climate change is happening and is threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?
Senator, again, I was wondering where you were going with that. You have asked me a series of questions like that are completely uncontroversial, like whether COVID-19 is infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and then trying to analogize that to eliciting an opinion on me that is a very contentious matter, opinion from me that is on a very contentious matter of public debate. And I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett. And you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
During 2 days of hearings, Amy Coney Barrett repeatedly refused to answer questions about her views on abortion and the future of Roe v. Wade, despite her public record opposing reproductive rights. In 2006, Barrett signed a newspaper advertisement that stated, quote, "It's time to put an end to the barbaric legacy of Roe v. Wade and restore laws that protect the lives of unborn children," unquote. Meanwhile, Barrett is facing criticism for failing to initially disclose in her Senate filings her record of speaking to anti-choice groups at Notre Dame. Barrett has already amended her filing once after CNN uncovered evidence she gave 2 talks in 2013 to anti-abortion groups at the school. CNN has now revealed Barrett also spoke to, or at least was scheduled to speak to, an anti-choice group in 2007. Under Senate rules, Barrett is required to provide a list of all public talks she's given in her professional career. One unusual moment from Wednesday's hearing occurred when Republican Senator Tom Tillis questioned Barrett about voting in the upcoming election.
I, for one, hope that every registered voter in this country vote on November 11th. That may be a stretch goal, but do you agree with that?
Of course, yes.
For the record, Election Day is November 3rd, not November 11th. U.S. felony disenfranchisement will bar 5.2 million American citizens from voting in November's election. That's according to a new report by the Sentencing Project, which finds nearly 2.5% of the voting-age U.S. population is disenfranchised due to a felony conviction. In North Carolina, a federal judge ruled Wednesday absentee ballots submitted by mail must have a third-party witness signature. The ruling, which will make it harder for people to safely vote during the pandemic, was celebrated by North Carolina Republicans. In California, Republican Party officials say they will refuse a cease and desist order to remove falsely labeled drop boxes for mail-in ballots from public locations in several counties. After California's Secretary of State threatened criminal prosecutions, Republican officials removed the word official from labels reading official ballot drop-off boxes, but said they would defy an order to remove the boxes entirely by Thursday. President Trump voiced support support for the scheme, tweeting, "Fight hard, Republicans. They've been taking advantage of the system for years," unquote. Meanwhile, videos obtained by The Washington Post show how a network of conservative activists has made opposition to mail-in ballots a central priority of the 2020 campaign. This is Bill Walton, president of the Council for National Policy's Executive Committee, speaking on August 21st.
This is a spiritual battle we are in. This is good versus evil, and we have to do everything we can to win.
Another video filmed in August shows 26-year-old conservative activist Charlie Kirk celebrating the closure of college campuses due to the coronavirus, saying it will lead to Republican victories at the polls.
The Democrats have done a really foolish thing by shutting down all these campuses. Foolish for them. It's going to remove ballot harvesting opportunities and all their voter fraud that they usually do on college campuses. So they're actually removing like 500,000 votes off the table. So please keep the campuses closed. Like, it's a great thing.
In California, Pacific Gas and Electric has issued power shutoffs for tens of thousands of homes across the Bay Area and Northern California, facing dry conditions and high winds that threaten to make the state's worst fire season on record even worse. This comes as new research shows, due to the climate crisis, California's fire weather days will double in some parts of the state by the end of the century. The Trump administration says it's planning to welcome Indonesia's defense minister to the Pentagon today, despite U.S. laws barring the entry of people accused of major human rights abuses. General Prabowo Subianto has been implicated in mass killings in East Timor, Papua and Aceh, as well as the kidnapping and torture of activists in Jakarta. He also worked directly with the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency and U.S. Special Forces in Indonesia. Prabowo had been banned from visiting the United States under Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. In Thailand, the government cracked down on pro-democracy protesters Thursday, imposing a state of emergency in an effort to quell the ongoing student-led government movement to remove the prime minister. Two protest leaders and at least 20 pro-democracy activists were arrested early Thursday morning in Bangkok after tens of thousands gathered outside the prime minister's office. The state of emergency bans gatherings of more than five people and prohibits news media that is a so-called threat to national security. In Honduras, environmental activist Arnold Joaquin Morazan Erazo was shot and killed in his home earlier this week, according to local media. He was reportedly one of 32 water defenders targeted and criminalized for protesting an open pit mine in the community of Guapinol. Violence against land and water defenders and indigenous leaders in Honduras has skyrocketed since the U.S.-backed coup in 2009. The Vatican held its first-ever sexual abuse trial Wednesday with two Catholic priests. Priest 28-year-old Gabriel Martinelli is accused of sexually assaulting an altar boy between 2007 and 2012 in a seminary in Vatican City. An older priest is accused of covering up the abuse. The trial comes as the Catholic Church faces ongoing criticism that it's not doing enough to battle endemic sexual abuse within the church and a culture that covers it up. And in Louisville, Kentucky, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, who was in bed with Taylor when police shot and killed her in a hail of gunfire in her own apartment in March, said Wednesday that police did not attempt to save Breonna Taylor as she lay dying. He also told CBS's Gail King that no one identified themselves in the deadly no-knock police raid that led to Breonna Taylor's death.
A loud bang at the door. No, nobody was responding. We were saying, who is it?
You all did ask, who is it?
Several times, both of us. And there was no response.
You know, the police say that they said several times, it's the police.
If they knock on the door and say who it was, we can hear them. It's dead silent. I know 1,000,000% sure that nobody identified themselves.
This comes less than a month after a grand jury failed to charge any of the three officers who conducted the raid with the killing of Breonna Taylor. On Wednesday, a second grand juror joined a motion to lift the gag order on the grand jury proceedings in order to speak publicly about the decision. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. When we come back, we'll host a debate on herd immunity and how best to confront coronavirus. Stay with us. Resistance Revival Chorus featuring Rhiannon Giddens, All You Fascists Bound to Lose. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I am Amy Goodman here in New York City, joined remotely by my co-host, Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Good morning, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, the United States reported nearly 60,000 new coronavirus cases on Wednesday, the highest daily toll since August. About 1,000 U.S. residents died of COVID-19 Wednesday, bringing the death toll since March to nearly 217,000, the highest death toll in the world. This comes as the Washington Post and the New York Times report that Trump administration officials say they've adopted a policy of deliberately letting the virus infect much of the U.S. population in order to attain herd immunity. Health experts warn the strategy might not even be possible and could lead to more than 2 million U.S. deaths. In Geneva, Switzerland, the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said Monday herd immunity should only be reached through vaccination, not natural infection.
Herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it. Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak, let alone a pandemic. It's scientifically and ethically problematic. In most countries, less than 10% of the population have been infected with the COVID-19 virus. Letting the virus circulate unchecked, therefore, means allowing unnecessary infections, suffering, and death.
While the World Health Organization is warning nations not to adapt a herd immunity strategy, some epidemiologists and doctors have embraced it. A group of three professors and doctors who teach at Harvard, Stanford, and Oxford recently co-authored an open letter in defense of herd immunity. It's known as the Great Barrington Declaration. The letter begins, quote, "As infectious disease epidemiologists and public health scientists, we have grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies and recommend an approach we call focused protection." The letter goes on to state, quote, "Those who are not vulnerable should immediately be allowed to resume life as normal." The Great Barrington Declaration is named after a town in western Massachusetts, which is home to the American Institute for Economic Research, a Koch brother-funded think tank that sponsored the open letter. Many other public health experts have expressed alarm over this call to embrace herd immunity. On Wednesday, a group of doctors and scientists signed an open letter in the Lancet Medical Journal stating, quote, "The evidence is very clear. Controlling community spread of COVID-19 is the best way to protect our societies and economies until safe and effective vaccines and therapeutics arrive within the coming months." The open letter is being called the John Snow Memorandum, named after the founder of modern epidemiology. Today, we host a debate on this contentious issue. Joining us from Ashford, Connecticut, is Martin Kulldorff, a professor of medicine at Harvard University, one of the three lead signers of the Great Barrington Declaration. He's a biostatistician, epidemiologist with expertise in detecting and monitoring infectious disease outbreaks and vaccine safety evaluations. Joining us from Boston is Dr. Abrar Karan, an internal medicine doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's worked on the COVID-19 public health response in Massachusetts since February, as well as directly cared for COVID-19 patients. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Kulldorff, you have signed this very controversial letter, what's being called the Great Barrington Declaration. Can you explain what it is and why you support what's called herd immunity?
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me on the show. The lockdown and the response that we have done in the world towards the pandemic is the worst assault on the working class in half a century. One feature of COVID-19 is that while anybody can be infected, there's a huge difference in risk by age. And it's not just twofold or fivefold or tenfold. It's not even hundredfold. There is a more than a thousandfold difference in risk by age for mortality of COVID-19. So what we're doing now with the current strategy that's been in place since the beginning of the year is we are protecting low-risk college students and low-risk professionals like bankers, scientists like me, journalists like you, while putting the burden on the working class who are forced to work as a bus driver, a janitor, or working in the supermarket, even if they are old. So we are protecting low-risk, privileged professionals while putting the burden on the working class, including high-risk working class people who have to work, to build the immunity that eventually will protect everybody in the community.
Dr. Abrar Karan, you've been tweeting away and certainly, to say the least, discussing the Great Barrington Declaration, but more importantly, broader than that, have definitely criticized herd immunity. Talk about your major concerns and what you think needs to be done.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, I'll start by saying that there is a bit of a false dichotomy when we talk about the options being either these extreme lockdowns versus just letting the virus rip and having herd immunity. In fact, if we think back to when we initially locked down, the strategy for doing that was actually to slow down transmission of cases so that they didn't overwhelm our healthcare systems, and also to build up an actual epidemic response, whereby we could actually have strong surveillance over where new outbreaks were occurring, where we could actually still test, trace, isolate new cases as they were occurring. And so I think the way that this is being framed is problematic, because neither, to me, are actually strategies. On the one hand, lockdowns are actually emergency backstops to stop transmission when it gets completely out of hand. And we saw that happen here in the United States, and we saw other countries that actually dealt with this quickly and actually used test tracing and isolating and masking from the start so that they never had enormous outbreaks that they could no longer control. Now, on the other hand, you've got this herd immunity, which, you know, typically, as you've heard the WHO Director General say, we're talking about this in terms of vaccinating people, not just exposing them to the disease, but actually giving them a vaccine that is not going to make them sick or make them need to be hospitalized or suffer further consequences from this. So in terms of my particular critiques, you know, I take care of patients. I've seen so many COVID patients since the start of the epidemic. Now, if somebody were to tell me that we were going to have an age-based protection whereby you just are isolating people who are older and letting other people run free and get infected, I'll tell you this, many of my most vulnerable patients live in crowded households that are intergenerational households, and they are the support systems for older people. So when you have invisible spread of a virus like this, inevitably it will go from the first layer of younger people who may not get as sick, and it will make its way to people who will get more sick. And those are the people that we are seeing in the hospital. And you know, beyond that, I would say this. when we overly focus on who is dying from this, we are ignoring the fact that this is a novel respiratory pathogen. Even in younger people, even in middle-aged people, we are seeing longer-term comorbidities and morbidity effects, such as long COVID, neurologic effects. You know, just recently this week, I've seen patients with this. So I think that aspect is also not being taken into account. And beyond that, if you're talking about a herd immunity where you're letting 60% or so of this population get infected, you're talking about 60% of 330 million people in this country. That is going to overwhelm our healthcare system, absolutely. And it's going to make everything much worse than it was even earlier on.
Dr. Kulldorff, I'd like you to respond to what Dr. Karan said and also to some of the criticisms that have been made of the Barrington Declaration, including by very prominent figures, Francis Collins, the National Institutes of Health director, called the declaration fringe and dangerous. The declaration has also been faulted for not citing any data. And another prominent epidemiologist, Greg Gonzalez, has said that the forced protection strategy you advocate is not a plan, but a massacre. And then also this Dr. Karan just pointed out that the key issue or the only issue should not be mortality rates, which is what the declaration focuses on, given the number of instances that we've seen among younger populations of morbidities that are long-lasting, including possibly permanent damage to the heart and lungs, the so-called long COVID. Why is it that the declaration only looks at mortality rates and not certainly long-term effects of the virus and possibly even permanent ones among younger populations?
So in combination, the three of you, I think that was about 20 things to respond to. So I will just tell that you can watch that goes with the declaration for detail those things. I would also like to say that when Amy characterized this declaration, there was a number of errors that she made, and maybe in a different program tomorrow she can correct those mistakes. I would say that one thing that is wrong is to have a debate about herd immunity is nonsensical. That's like having a debate among physicists about gravity. Herd immunity is a scientifically established phenomena that just exists. So to have, and every strategy that we use will eventually lead to herd immunity. So for us to discuss whether we should reach herd immunity, that's like having two pilots in an airplane discussing whether they should use gravity as a strategy to get the airplane down on the ground. The airplane will eventually get down on the ground no matter what. And the key thing is to minimize mortality. So we want to minimize mortality until this pandemic is over. And of the 20 things that you asked me about, maybe you should define one of them and I will respond to that one.
Well, firstly, why is it you've just talked about mortality rates again? Why is it that you're only looking at mortality rates and not long-term morbidities like possibly permanent damage to the lungs and heart among younger people and this phenomenon of long COVID, of which there have been many reports?
So first of all, in terms of long-term effects, we don't know anything about the long-term effects beyond 1 year for obvious reasons, because it hasn't been around for that long. In terms of long, six-month effects, that's a common thing for many infectious diseases, including the annual influenza. And there has been no reports that I have seen that shows that the long-term effects of COVID-19 is any more common than the long-term effects of the influenza.
Dr. Kulldorff, you said that I misspoke at the beginning. Why don't you correct what you think I said wrong?
Well, one thing is the debate about herd immunity. And another one thing is that the declaration is not arguing that anybody should go out and get infected. just like if you have car traffic, you let people drive a car, that doesn't mean that you let them go and get killed in a car accident, even though some will, and we know that some will. So we will let young people and children go to school, for example, and go to university for in-person teaching. That's extremely important for these children and for the students, not just for the education, but also for their physical health and their mental health, which is a major concern, this collateral damage. So we are not letting people get infected. That's nonsense, and nobody should go deliberately become infected. But young people who are at very minimal risk, for children, the risk of for COVID is less than the annual influenza, which typically kills between 200 and 1,000 children every year. So the risk to them is very, very low. When we let them live, we need to let them live their lives to get their education, to have proper physical health and mental health. But that doesn't mean that we're trying to pursue a herd immunity strategy or try to get people to get infected. So that's a very, very serious and major mischaracterization of this declaration. And I think it's very serious that people are making those, because we need to have an open debate about these things. And it's just not the three of us who authored this, who have signed this declaration, who I think comes from reasonably respectable universities. We also have, for example, the former chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health, who have signed this declaration. So very prominent people, very prominent scientists have signed this, and so on. So this is not a fringe opinion at all. Also, if you go back a year only, what we are proposing is just the same thing as every country in Europe had in their pandemic response plans, because we knew there were going to be a pandemic at some point, and there will be more after this one. So what we are proposing is basic public health principles that was in every one of these pandemic plans in Europe, and that were thrown out of the window at the beginning of this year, instead doing this very tragic experiment with lockdowns. And it was right to flatten the curve, to not overwhelm the hospitals. That was the correct strategy that everybody agrees with. But then to try to suppress and eliminate a disease that cannot be eliminated, that cannot be eradicated, is very misguided, and it leads to, it has in the United States led to much higher mortality than there should have been if we had done a focused protection strategy instead.
Dr. Khan, I'd like you to respond to what Dr. Kulldorff has said, what he said earlier about the disproportionate impact of this, of the lockdowns and the policies that have been pursued on the working class and protecting the relatively privileged while compromising the well-being of the working class who've been forced to work even through these lockdowns. And in particular, you've worked in Asia as well as in Latin America and in Africa. The effects there, of course, have been far more devastating than here or in Europe, with several recent reports warning of hundreds of millions of people being pushed into poverty, potentially, as Oxfam reported, up to 12,000 people starving a day, a widespread crisis in education for hundreds of millions of children who potentially, because they don't have access to home education, could induce a generational crisis in education in many of these countries. How is it that these impacts can be reduced on vulnerable populations all across the world by doing something other than lockdowns in countries that are resource poor and can't necessarily afford alternative strategies?
Absolutely. So the focus for so many of us has been around the fact that strategies have left behind some of the most poor and vulnerable people in our society. And this is not a surprise. This has happened before the pandemic. We have so much inequity. And the focus of the response has to be on protecting the most vulnerable. So if you think back to our response in the United States in May, once we realized there was a disproportionate impact on people of color, who were frontline workers, who lived in crowded housing, who were not able to stay home while the rest of us were able to, what we should have done is protect these populations, making sure that they have access to the PPE that they need, access to paid leave, access to safer working conditions. Nobody's arguing with that at all. And, you know, when we characterize certain countries, as you mentioned, I've worked in sub-Saharan Africa. Actually, I'll tell you, a lot of those countries are sort of mischaracterized in the sense that there's an assumption that they won't be able to handle pandemics or respond to pandemics. Actually, some of these countries are true experts well beyond what we are in the United States in terms of how to utilize the fundamentals of epidemic response, such as testing, tracing, isolating, wearing masks. So, you know, I had a colleague who was in Rwanda earlier this year. He said when he landed in the airport, they checked his symptoms. They had exactly the seat that he sat in on the plane, exactly where he would be staying. They checked his temperature, and they made sure that they were going to follow out any sort of cases that happened so that they could trace and isolate people. And he said on the other hand, when he came back to the United States, he walked right in. Nobody asked a single question, and there he went. You know, I wanted to address something that Dr. Kulldorff had said, which was that it's silly to not talk about herd immunity. Well, actually, nobody is saying that we aren't talking about herd immunity. We're talking about herd immunity with a vaccine. We have been pushing forward to get a vaccine. And I know that Dr. Kulldorff himself on other podcasts has mentioned that a vaccine is an important part of any strategy to control the epidemic, right? It's not going to be a silver bullet. And we're not going to likely eliminate COVID, but we need to get it to extremely low levels. And so many countries have proven that there's ways to do this when you stick to the fundamentals of epidemic response. And so why is it that in our country, we are pushing towards making an excuse to not do that work and instead use a theoretical strategy, which I think pragmatically just won't work based on all of the patients I've talked to? For us, this is the real deal. I've talked to people who have been infected with COVID, who infected family members in their home because of the conditions that they lived in, and they were killed by inequity, and they were killed by an incompetence of the response.
So let's talk about that incompetence of the response. Dr. Kulldorff, I was wondering if you could describe your White House meeting, the meeting you had with Alex Azar, the head of Health and Human Services, when you went to lay out the herd immunity, your herd immunity push. And this is what I wanted to ask. You have laid this out as lockdown, which we all agree has horrific effects, from massive joblessness, tens of millions of people out of work, the psychological effects of all of this, poverty, to name a few. Let it rip. So you don't have a lockdown, just let it go through because those effects are less bad, you say. Did you argue to Azar, for him to argue to the president, that talking about the response of the U.S., the lack of tests, the lack of masks, that first and foremost to protect everyone would be, as we often look at Europe, why look at Europe? What about Asia? What about Taiwan, Singapore, China, Laos, Vietnam, how they have contained this virus with sane public health measures that are supported by the vast majority of public health professionals.
So you're again doing a mischaracterization by claiming that this is a push for herd immunity or to let things rip through society. That's the very opposite of the Great Barrington Declaration.
So explain.
There is basically three major strategies one can use. One can do nothing, and that's very, very bad. Because if we do nothing, then we're going to have some old and some young people get infected. And with old people infected, some of them are going to die, and we're going to have high mortality. If we do a strategy that protects everybody equally, irrespective of age, we are pushing the pandemic forward in time. But eventually, people are still going to be infected. And there will be some old and some young people getting infected. And since a fair amount of old people are infected, we will have higher mortality. On the other hand, if we do a focused protection, which is what the Great Barrington Declaration proposes, by focusing the protection on the high-risk elderly instead of the privileged members of society, some of which are old and some of which are young. So if we focus the protection of the high-risk elderly and other high-risk group while letting young people live their lives, then we will have fewer older people getting infected, but we'll have more younger people getting infected. We will also shorten the time of the pandemic so that older people will make it easier for older people to protect themselves, because they only have to self-isolate for a number of months instead of what is now is going to be more than a year. So that will help them protect. And if we do that, then we will have lower mortality because there will be fewer of the old people who get infected.
Dr. Kultoff, could you talk specifically, because of course the declaration advocates opening schools. What do we know about the infection rates of children and their the likelihood that children, if they go to schools, could come home and infect their parents? And the second question is, what do we know about the percentage of people who have an infection who develop serious symptoms, not necessarily die from the infection, but develop serious infections versus those who remain either asymptomatic or develop light symptoms?
The second question, most young people are asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic only. Old people, this is a major danger to them, especially for mortality. What we know about children, we actually know a lot about children. And if we think like scientists, we have to see what happens if schools are open during the pandemic. And there's only one country in the Western world, major country, who kept schools open during the height of the pandemic during the spring, and that was Sweden. So if we want to answer that question, we have to look at Sweden. So Sweden kept childcare and schools open from ages 1 to 15 throughout the pandemic, when there was a lot of transmission in society. There were 1.8 million children in this age group. And during the spring and early summer, there were exactly zero children who died from COVID-19 among these 1.8 million. There were half a dozen or so ICU and some hospitalizations. But for children, this is not a dangerous thing compared to, for example, the annual influenza that kills much more children every year. They also looked at the teachers, because maybe the children will infect the teachers. And they found that teachers had the same risk of COVID as the average of other professions. And since some other professions worked at home, it actually had lower risk than those other professions who were actually on site. So that shows that the risk of children infecting adults is very small. And that has also been shown through genetic studies from Iceland, where they look at the genetics of the virus to see how it spread, for whether you can see if it spreads from the parent to the child or from the child to the parents, and most transmission was from the parent to the child.
We're going to break
so
and then come back.
There's no public health reason to keep schools closed. They should all be open for in-person teaching, and same with universities. If children are sick, stay at home. And older teachers, if they are in the 60s, they are high risk. So there should be ways to let them work from home, either by doing online teaching or by helping other teachers, creating exams or homework or essay and stuff like that.
Dr. Kultoff, I wanted to ask you about a report from Sky News and The Hill. You have White House officials promoting herd immunity declarations signed by fake names. This is the Great Barrington Declaration. Report found last week, Sky News found dozens of fake names that signed the document, including Dr. I.P. Freely, Dr. Person Fake Name, Dr. Johnny Bananas. Another signatory called himself Dr. Harold Shipman, a general practitioner in United Kingdom. In 1998, a man named Harold Shipman was arrested after killing more than 200 of his patients. What can you say about this?
So I'm a simple scientist. So I actually have a question for you, because we have 500,000 people have signed this, including thousands of very prominent medical and public health scientists. we also put up, we also sort of show that for the sort of the fun of it, that somebody named Johnny Bananas had done that, clearly being a fake name, which we are removing. So why are you asking about Johnny Bananas instead of many of these thousands of very prominent scientists who have signed this declaration?
Well,
I'm a simple scientist, so this is something with the media that obviously you know more about than I. So I think, why is that?
Well, it's looking at the list of the signatories. But let's put the question to Dr. Abrakaran, because the suggestion here is that is whether Dr. Kohldorf's declaration represents the majority view in this country, and specifically this issue of what we absolutely know would save tens of thousands of lives in this country, masks and tests. And the fact that they are not available freely all over this country, hundreds of millions of them. Dr. Karen, can you address this issue of what you think would save lives until there's a vaccine that would create herd immunity, and particularly talk about children? Dr. Kohldorf saying schools should remain open. But what we know about children today?
Absolutely. So for me, and for many physicians, nurses, frontline healthcare providers, infectious disease epidemiologists, scientists, we are not here to try to push forward our agendas. We are here to listen to the science and to save people's lives. And so we want to stick to the fundamentals of epidemic response: testing, tracing, isolating, masking, better ventilation, and listening to the science. So if the science ends up pointing to us having very little spread in schools, then as you know, there are trade-offs to everything that we do. There are costs to keeping kids out of school. And so we must adapt to what the science shows. But the underlying fundamentals here are things that we just have not been doing, despite knowing that we need to be doing this, right? And you've listed them. Right, we need to have masks. We need to have PPE for our most vulnerable frontline workers. Right, as we move indoors for the winter, and we know now CDC has acknowledged the role of aerosol-based spread. We need to have better ventilation systems in place. Right, we need to stick to testing and increasing testing and using testing in more unique and innovative ways. So people have talked about rapid antigen testing. People have talked about trying to scale up these types of tests. People have talked about smarter tracing. So many states are now moving into digital tracing to help us get more quick and efficient in terms of figuring out who's infected and notifying people that need to quarantine and get tested quickly, right? These are things that other countries had already been doing. These are things that we were slower to adapt, but we're moving towards doing that. And I think that when we move away from putting in the work and instead are focused on silver bullets or on strategies that are just not ideal and have a lot of costs that we can't even identify fully right now, we're going to head into trouble. So those are my thoughts on it.
Well, Dr. Karen, could you also, in a recent article, you've said that what's needed is an epidemiological autopsy for all COVID cases, suggesting that the focus should be on detecting and stopping enough transmission chains. So first of all, could you respond to the earlier question about children and whether they're safe from the virus and can go to schools, or that they don't spread, either of those things, if they're true? And then also the fact that some studies on this question of transmission, studies have shown that most people don't seem to transmit the virus, and only a small percentage are responsible for almost all infections. What do we know about that study, those studies? And do you think that's the case from what you've seen?
And we have less than a minute.
So both questions, the children and transmission.
Absolutely. So on the first, this is something that Dr. Ranu Dhillon and I have talked about, which is figuring out how transmission is continuing to happen. And what we can do is use genomic sequencing to figure out where people may have gotten infected. So in the case of schools, let's say you see that that kids are getting infected, but they may not actually be infecting one another, then you may say, actually, there's not a lot of transmission happening within the school. And so the benefit of schools may outweigh the costs. Secondly, as you mentioned, the spread of COVID-19 is through clusters. And so if that's the case, then we need to stop those clusters from happening. Certain countries like Japan have focused on that. They have the three C's: avoid crowds, avoid close contact, and avoid closed spaces. If we can do that, we can stop these large super spreading events, and we can actually drive the epidemic into lower levels that are manageable and that don't continue to surge and create epidemics that we then have to think about ways to stop drastically, such as lockdowns. So those would be my thoughts to those two questions.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for being with us. And of course, Thanksgiving is coming up. Dr. Fauci has warned people should not gather from all over the country with their families inside in close community, sadly, fearing for the further spread of the virus than going back to their communities wherever they live and spreading it further. Dr. Abrarkaran, thanks so much for being with us, speaking to us from Boston, teaches at Harvard Medical School and the Brigham and Women's Children's Hospital. And thanks so much to Martin Kulldorff, professor of medicine at Harvard University, speaking to us from Connecticut. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, excerpts of the Senate confirmation hearing for Amy Coney Barrett. Stay with us. July performed live by Sufjan Stevens. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We spend the rest of the hour, the rest of this time, looking at the Senate confirmation hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is reconvening today for the final hearing for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, the right-wing judge who once clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia. If confirmed, she gives conservatives a 6-3 majority on the high court. Judge Barrett faced 8 hours of questions Wednesday after a marathon, 11 hours Tuesday, as Republicans raced to confirm her before Election Day. We end with some of the key exchanges from Wednesday's hearing, such as this one between Democratic Senator Kamala Harris, Joe Biden's running mate, when Judge Barrett refused to say if she thinks climate change is happening.
Climate change, as many have mentioned, is an existential threat, and its effects are all around us. Do you accept that COVID-19 is infectious?
I think, yes, I do accept that COVID-19 is infectious. That's something of which I feel like, you know, we could say you take judicial notice of. It's an obvious fact, yes.
Do you accept that smoking causes cancer?
I'm not sure exactly where you're going with this, but, you know, the notice that smoking
causes... It's just a question. The question is what it is. You can answer it if you believe yes or no.
Senator Harris, yes, every package of cigarettes warns that smoking causes cancer.
And do you believe that climate change is happening and is threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?
Senator, again, I was wondering where you were going with that. You have asked me a series of questions like that are completely uncontroversial, like whether COVID-19 is infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and then trying to analogize that to eliciting an opinion on me that is a very contentious matter, opinion from me that is on a very contentious matter of public debate. And I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett. And you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
That's Senator Kamala Harris questioning Judge Barrett. During 2 days of hearings, Judge Barrett has repeatedly refused to answer questions about her views on abortion and the future of Roe v. Wade, despite her public record opposing reproductive rights. Judge Barrett also repeatedly dodged questions on the Supreme Court's Obergefell versus Hodges ruling, which said same-sex couples could not be denied the right to marry. This is her exchange with Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
Correctly decided, Obergefell versus Hodges.
Senator Blumenthal, every time you ask me a question about whether a case was correctly decided or not, I cannot answer that question because I cannot suggest agreement or disagreement with precedents of the Supreme Court. All of those precedents bind me now as a Seventh Circuit judge, and were I to be confirmed, I would be responsible for applying the law of stare decisis to all of them.
But, Your Honor, think of how you would feel as a gay or lesbian American, to hear that you can't answer whether the government can make it a crime for them to have that relationship, whether the government can enable people who are happily married to continue that relationship.
Senator,
think of how you would feel.
Well, Senator, you're implying that I'm poised to say that I want to cast a vote to overrule Obergefell, and I assure you I don't have any agenda, and I'm not even expressing a view in disagreement of Obergefell. You're pushing me to try to violate the judicial canons of ethics and to offer advisory opinions, and I won't do that.
And I'm not asking you hypotheticals. These are real cases. First, Brown versus Board of Education. Do you think it was correctly decided? I know you told Senator Graham you thought so. I'd like you just to clarify that point.
Sure. So as I said to Senator Graham when he asked me that question, I have spoken on that before in the originalism lecture that I give.
As you sit here, and correctly decided, right?
Correctly decided, and yes, I've said that.
Thank you. Let me ask you about Loving versus the Loving case. Do you think that was correctly decided?
Well, Loving follows directly from Brown. Brown is correctly decided, Loving as well.
It was correctly decided.
It was correctly decided.
That was Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut questioning Judge Amy Coney Barrett. For the we're going to turn right now to an unusual moment, which was the North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis in a hotly contested race questioning Amy Coney Barrett.
I just want to make sure I heard you right in your responses to other questions. You do feel very strongly that every American should have safe access to the vote. And I, for one, hope that every registered voter in this country vote on November 11th. That may be a stretch goal, but do you agree with that?
Of course, yes.
For the record, Election Day is November 3rd, not November 11th. And then we turn to New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker questioning Judge Barrett about her views on race.
And this year, clearly, we've been grappling as a nation with a lot of these issues, and it is a part of our longstanding history. You cannot divorce the role of judges in our history over these some 200 years and how race has been a persistent part of the national narrative, grappling with deep issues of bigotry and bias, overt as well as the biases that exist. We know that many of the unjust deaths of unarmed African Americans at the hands of law enforcement have brought this even more into public, more into public concern.
Booker.
I was actually asking specifically any books you can name that you've read on this subject or law review articles, anything that you specifically read outside of the sentencing guidelines.
Well, Senator Booker, I would say that what I have learned about it has mostly been in conversations with people and, you know, at Notre Dame, as at many other universities, it's a topic of conversation in classrooms, but it's not something that I can say, yes, I've done research on this and read X, Y, and Z.
You're not citing articles or research that you've read on this issue, yet you have written here about it. And to me, that speaks, it makes me wonder and want to talk to you a little bit about your preparedness and priorities, taking the highest office in the judicial world that deals with such long-standing issues of race and in a way that affects the totality of the lives of Americans.
That was Senator Booker questioning Judge Barrett. Republican Senator Ben Sasse asked Judge Barrett to name the five freedoms outlined in the First Amendment. She could name four.
What are the five freedoms of the First Amendment?
Speech, religion, press, assembly. Speech, press, religion, assembly. I don't know. What am I missing?
Redress or protest.
Okay.
Some of the highlights. We'll talk more about these hearings on Friday's broadcast. And you can go to democracynow.org to watch the live stream of today's final day of the hearing and all the Senate confirmation hearing for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.